For those of you who are taking this course for a grade, the grade consists of, gosh, I look too, this is too bright, but nothing I can do about it now. We'll just live with it. You just take four, what is it? Is it four quizzes or three quizzes? I think I'm mixing up my courses. I think in this course it's just three quizzes. But the point is that the way it works is I will on the Tuesday before the quiz, I will, by the end of the day on that Tuesday, you'll be able to see the questions for the quiz will be posted. The question, there'll just be multiple choice, but you'll see the questions without any multiple choice answers. But it gives you, you know, helps direct your reading, gives you a sense of what's going to be covered. And then that Friday, then the whole quiz, the questions and possible answers will go live, and then you'll have until Sunday at midnight to submit your answers. And that's it. So I want you to understand that, of course, if you choose not to take the course for a grade, I will not think less of you. If you decide, or if you, let's say you take the quizzes and you don't do so well, I also won't think badly of you. I mean, I know how busy we all are. I'm amazed that you're able to spend this time with me in the first place. Gosh, I don't know why I put that crazy light on. I look terrible in this. It's too bright. Golly, what is this? Good grief. No, that's it. I got to set this off. No, this is just too much. That is just too much. Let's see. Dimmer switch up there. Yeah, it's just too bright. I mean, I can move back. That's already as far back as well. I want to move it off to the side a little bit. All right. I'm sorry. I know I should do this in advance, but all right. Well, that's somewhat better, right? That's a little bit better. Okay. Here we go. All right, we're going to run through these slides, and we're going to chit-chat a little bit. We're going to be talking about here just sort of the background stuff. And some of this is a little bit technical. I realize that. You by no means do you need to be an expert on some of this technical stuff. And Rothbard is using terms, you know, like he expects you to just know them. Like he's using terms like bankers' acceptances, for example, you know, as if everybody knows what that is, or call rates and things like that. So if you want to ask about those things, I'll gladly answer those questions during the question period. So, all right, anyway, off we go. Let's dive into our slides here. Okay, well, first I want to say a little something about the American economy in the 1920s. We should note that the 1920s were indeed a time of great prosperity, although they did not begin that way. We now know, or if we've seen a lot more work done recently on this economic downturn of 1920 to 1921. And during that time, we saw sharp double-digit declines in production and employment. And yet the economy bounced back from this very quickly. And Joseph Schumpeter, who was not himself an Austrian, and by that I mean he wasn't an Austrian economist of the Austrian school, but he was a great 20th century economist and a fantastic writer. So it's interesting for him to, oh, how long has it been? It depends. Each week could be different. Could go an hour, could go 45 minutes, could be an hour and 10 minutes, probably average about an hour-ish. And then at that point, if you don't have to stick around for the questions, I mean, you don't even have to stick around for this. You can watch it at your leisure if you like. Anyway, and also just so you guys know, so you won't think I'm being rude, I typically don't watch the chat window when I'm doing these because I can't keep my mind focused. So I'll look at the chat afterward and then we'll interact that way. But anyway, he says that this 1920 episode shows better than any theory could how the system pulls itself out of troughs under its own steam and how it succeeds in doing so while the price level is falling. And I note here, I have this article from the Intercollegiate Review a couple years ago, Warren Harding and the Forgotten Depression of 1920. If you want to read more about this, it's very interesting. This article, you can find it at tomwoods.com on my articles page. You can find it at lewrockwell.com. You can find it at mises.org. I think you can find it at the Intercollegiate Studies Institute website. I mean, there's no shortage of outlets for it. But during this downturn, 1920 to 21, the money supply falls very more sharply than in any other episode, including the Great Depression. And yet, the economy had already begun to rebound before the Federal Reserve did anything to reverse that decline. You can go to the St. Louis Fed, which is the website where you really begin to see, where you can really see, you can generate your own graphs, and you can generate a graph for this, and you can see that the money supply goes down like this, and it doesn't begin to come back up again until 1922. But the National Bureau of Economic Research says that the recession or depression was already over by the late summer of 1921. So supposedly, well, this should just cause a deflationary spiral that would just go on and on forever until we pump more money into the system. That is absolutely not what happened. The system corrected itself without that. Okay. The prosperity of the 1920s. Now, let me first just preface this with, of course, the not very subtle lesson that we draw from that 1920 to 21 episode is that, by and large, there was a hands-off response. The Fed responded only after things were already turning around. The federal government was cutting its expenditures all during the time of the recovery. It was not increasing them with public works stimulus spending. It was cutting them all through that time. We then have the fact that, yes, it's true, there was a kind of Keynesian, or at least a kind of stimulus that could have a Keynesian interpretation. Namely, there were tax cuts that we'll talk about in a minute. But those tax cuts didn't really kick in until, again, after the recovery was already underway. So there does not appear to have been a stimulus program, and yet we had this fairly rapid recovery from a pretty wrenching downturn. So I don't want to suggest that, you know, because when we read Rothbard, we can be inclined to think that the 1920s, that it was all a sham, and that's certainly not his thesis, but people might caricature it that way. He's not claiming that there was no real prosperity in the 1920s. He's arguing there were problems with the prosperity, and that some of it was only apparent prosperity. But there's no denying that it was an enormously prosperous decade. We have a very high rate of capital formation, that is, people are saving very substantially, and that saving provides the wherewithal for businesses to borrow and to carry out capital projects that increase their productive capacity, whether they open a new plant or have a new assembly line or a new type of machine or whatever it is that increases their output. Well, that's made possible by the saving that's going on. And in turn, investment in these machines makes American laborers more productive. You're more productive with a steam shovel than you are with a regular shovel. You can do more. And that means you can help bring about greater abundance of goods in the economy and therefore increase everybody's real incomes. Unemployment rate remains under 4% throughout the 20s after 1921, except for peaks of 5% in 1924 and 4.2% in 1928. At one point in 1927, the unemployment rate actually hit 1%. Which I don't think we've ever seen that, I mean, anything like that ever since. And then in constant dollars, we see a 45% increase in the GDP in 8 years. But here's my favorite statistic, because it's so astonishing. The United States, as a share of all the production going on in the whole world, the United States is producing more than one-third of all the goods in the whole world. And so Britain and Germany are the next two highest economic powers, and they're tied with just over 10%. It's absolute U.S. domination. And it's basically it's a more or less free market decade. Unfortunately, the less part is the part that's going to cause the headaches later on. Okay, let's move on to this slide here. Here I've reproduced a graph that people should be familiar with, just good to know about. First we'll just explain what this graph is, and then we'll apply it to the 1920s. You might have seen this graph tipped on its side 90 degrees, but this is in fact how Arthur Laffer actually drew it. And yes, it's the same Arthur Laffer who made the bet with Peter Schiff. But Arthur Laffer in the late 1970s developed something that became known as the Laffer curve. And I actually wrote the entry on the Laffer curve for the ISI Encyclopedia of Conservatism. Basically, it runs like this, that let's say the government charges 0%, has a 0% tax rate. How much revenue is it going to earn at 0%? Well, obviously zero. So what we're doing here is on the Laffer curve, we are plotting on the x-axis the amount of revenue the government earns, and on the y-axis the tax rate that it imposes on the people. So obviously at a tax rate of zero, the revenue is zero. So one point that we know is on this graph is 0, 0, so it's at the origin. And then secondly, we can imagine, let's suppose the government charges imposes a 100% tax rate. And here, of course, we're talking about marginal rates. Because right now the federal government has several different rates that it applies, be it 10%, 15%, all the way up to 33% and 35%. And it's not that the richest people, like somebody who earns $1 million, it's not that all of his income is assessed at 35%. No, the first like 100,000 is assessed at 10 or 15, and then only the amount above like 373,000 is taxed at 35%. That's what we mean by marginal rates. When you earn that additional dollar that takes you above that next income level, that's when, for the dollars above that, that's when that rate kicks in. So let's say the marginal rate is 100%. But let's say if you earn more than $30,000 a year, every dollar above that, at that marginal rate, every dollar above that will be taxed at 100%. Everything will be taken from you. You can imagine what you would do in response. I mean, probably you're not going to bother working after you hit $30,000 if you know it's all going to be taken. Or if you did continue working, I mean, you would do what a lot of people in that situation do. You would hide your income. You would cheat on your taxes. You would, as I say, you'd just stop working. I mean, all these things are possibilities. So, in other words, then, the number of people who are actually going to keep working at a point where their revenue is 100%, or pardon me, their tax rate is 100%, is pretty low. It's so low that we can safely round it off to zero. Most people just stop working. So the other point that we know is on the Laffer curve is the point 0, 100. $0 in revenue at 100% tax rate. Those are the only two points we know on the Laffer curve for certain. Everything else is pure speculation. But what Laffer did was he then drew a curve from between these two points. Now this one, the one that I've reproduced here, is not quite what Laffer's looked like, because he didn't make it like a perfect half oval. I mean, he had it's a somewhat distorted shape, because there's no particular reason to think that a 50% tax rate would yield you the highest revenue. That's just arbitrary. So don't be misled by how perfectly symmetrical the graph is. The point is that what Laffer is going to argue is that if you look along this graph and you go on the x-axis, you go from zero to, let's say, you know, $10, $50, $1,000, $1 million, and you keep on going to the right, you'll notice that as you continue to go to the right, the tax rate is, of course, going up. As the government charges more in taxes, you're earning as the government charges more in taxes, it's earning more in revenue. But that stops after a while. After a while, because of this factor that I mentioned before, people are going to stop working so much, or they're going to hide their income or whatever. So the government could keep on increasing the tax rate, but you notice that the revenue now is going to start swinging back the other way. The government could just start charging 80, 90% of taxes, and the revenue is just going to be about what it would have been if they had charged like 15 or 20% of taxes. So Laffer's argument is that we refer to this shaded region as the prohibitive range, the range beyond which, even from the government's own point of view, it makes no sense to keep increasing the tax rates because of the disincentive effects it has on the public. You're going to be disrupting economic activity, and you're going to have less revenue than if the tax rate had been lower. This is clearly a net minus for everybody involved. That was what Laffer was saying, but it's not simply the case that you just keep raising taxes and you just keep getting more revenues. At some point, it's going to start heading toward the point 0, 100. And at that stage, clearly you are in the prohibitive range. And you should just lower the tax rates, and it would be better for the government, it would be better for the public, it would be better for the economy, better for everybody. Now, Mellon's argument was that in the 1920s, the U.S. economy was in the prohibitive range. During World War I, the top marginal tax rate had gone up to about 73%, extremely high. So, you know, you would earn 27 cents for every dollar above a particular level, that marginal level, that you earned. You'd be able to keep 27 cents. And a lot of people at that point just figured, well, I'm not going to risk losing a full dollar, and all I could gain, if I gained anything, would be 27 cents. So what people were doing was all these strategies I mentioned, not working, whatever. Or they would take their money and put it in tax-free state and municipal bonds. It's tax-free. So that meant that states and cities had all this money they were getting from all these rich people who didn't want to be taxed, throwing their money into these tax-free bonds. So there were plenty of baseball parks and whatever. I mean, wildlife sanctuaries all over the place. But all this money's locked up in those things instead of generating production and employment and so on. So he thought, if you start lowering the rates, then people at these top levels will be more willing to expose their income to these rates, and you get more economic activity. So over the course of the 20s, between President Harding, who then died in office in 1923, and then Calvin Coolidge, who took over for him and then was elected in his own right in 1924, they're basically going to carry out Mellon's plan. And it's not just the top rates that are going to come down. All rates at all income levels will be reduced. And by the time you get to Coolidge, the top rate has been reduced. It was reduced to 40% under Harding and then down to 25% under Coolidge. And you notice, by the way, the top rate initially when the income tax was first imposed was about 7%. And then it goes up to 73. It's pretty high. And then in the 1920s, it gets back down to 25% and everybody cheers. But this is what Robert Higgs means by the ratchet effect. You notice that 25% is a lot lower than 73%. It's a lot higher than 7%. And Higgs argues that every time there's a crisis, it's a war or an economic crisis, government power ratchets upward. And then when the crisis passes, government power and revenues may ratchet downward somewhat, but never quite to the level they were at before the crisis occurred. And we see that also in the 1920s. So he does win these income tax reductions for all income groups. And in fact, government revenue did increase in the 1920s to the point that the federal government was able to reduce the national debt by one-third during that time. Okay, so that's the Laffer curve. And what I'm saying here is that Mellon actually anticipated the Laffer curve more than 50 years earlier. Okay, all right, I just said national debt reduced by one-third. You don't even have to cover that. The annual earnings of workers in manufacturing during the 20s rose by one-third, and hours worked fell by 5%. So working less and earning more. So it would be hard, again, to persuade people this was not. Now, it's not to say that the prosperity is shared evenly. Farmers had it difficult in the 20s. They had expanded during World War I, and then when that war ended and traditional trade flows were resumed, clearly the American farming sector had expanded too much. The world didn't need as much American agricultural products as it had during World War I. So they had a depressed time and so on. But the key statistic for me is that membership in the American Federation of Labor falls from 4 million to 2.7 million during the 20s. This is kind of interesting in light of modern controversies, because we're led to believe that, you know, labor union membership is an essential ingredient in working class prosperity. But to the contrary, union membership fell during one of the most prosperous decades ever, partly because it seemed to American workers that unions were superfluous. I mean, the wages are already rising and hours are already falling. What do I need these people for? They're just going to cause me problems. Then I assembled just some facts that I think are worth knowing about the development of the American economy in the 20s and the major changes that are going on in American life. Automobile production increasing very considerably. I mean, you know, perhaps, I guess, more than 2.5 times from 1917 to 1929. Household electrification. So we see in the decade from 1920 to 1930, urban and non-farm households, 47.4% of them have electricity. That goes up to 84.8%. Farms go from 1.6 to 10.4%. And in general, all dwellings, 34.7% were electrified, up to basically doubling that by 1930. And so as a result of that, a wide variety of appliances see their production increasing very dramatically. And so there's increased leisure, there's readily available transportation, and so as a result, there's greater demand for various forms of entertainment, ranging from movies to sporting events. So America is becoming sort of a mass consumer society. I mean, it had already been that since probably the 1870s, but really I think there's not just a quantitative but also a qualitative difference that's taking shape here. Now, it's particularly in the capital goods industries that the boom of the 1920s is evident. Capital goods are goods that are produced for the sake of bringing about further production. They're goods that are not consumed by consumers. They're consumed for the purpose of producing consumer goods. So, like, you and I don't just go out and buy some raw pig iron. That's a capital good. Pig iron and steel production, triple. Construction activity and machine tools output, more than triple. The growth in industrial production was more than double that in consumer goods. The stock market, which is the market in which titles to capital are exchanged, rises 50% in 1928 and another 27% between the beginning of 1929 and the eve of the crash. Now, why does this matter? Why even bother pointing this out? The significance of this aspect of the boom, that it's centered in the capital goods industries, will become evident after we talk about the Austrian business cycle theory. Now, these are, in case you find any of these statistics interesting, I by and large got them from these sources. This Gene Smiley book, it's a very good overview called The American Economy in the 20th Century. Larry White's book, The Clash of Economic Ideas. In fact, I'm not sure if that book is, I mean, I think I'm reading that in galleys. I'm not sure that book exists yet or something. But someday it'll be around, or if it's not around already. And Larry Schweikert's book, The Entrepreneurial Adventure. It's not without ambivalence that I mention Schweikert, but certainly that book is a very good one. And by the way, I suspect at least the Smiley book is out of print. And to get out of print books, the best kept secret in the world is bookfinder.com. Because it will bring together all the different small booksellers and then list them in order of how much the book costs at that particular seller. I mean, you're doing yourself a disservice not to use bookfinder.com. You can save a bundle on books. Okay, well, it wasn't all great, however. And does anybody know what I mean when I say the economy wasn't all hand and plaques? Does that reference ring a bell with anybody? I'm just curious. Does that ring a bell with anybody? Is this too obscure? Is this too obscure of a reference? Does anybody know when this was said? Does anybody know? All right, it's from The Simpsons. It's C. Montgomery Burns. Because Homer is awarded the Employee of the Month. And they give him a ham as a prize and a special plaque. And then, later on, he's required to go give a speech at a neighboring power plant, and he is terrified. It's the last thing in the world he wants to do. And Mr. Burns says to him, "Simpson, being Employee of the Month isn't all ham and plaques." So I've sort of adopted that as an expression that I use in day-to-day conversation. Well, look, it's not all ham and plaques. Well, the economy, see, this, it's not enough of a payoff, right? It's way too much buildup and not enough payoff. But I just love that phrase. It's not all ham and plaques. So it became customary at the time to speak of there being a new era of prosperity. The business cycle has been overcome. We won't have boom and bust anymore. And it's interesting to hear that because in the 1990s, when we had the dot-com boom and bust with the internet stocks, we heard that same kind of thing. Even Alan Greenspan, who was, of course, the Fed chairman at the time, said that we may have entered a period in which booms do not need to be followed by busts. I'll happily say tax cuts were great, economy was great, but I've got to put in there this caveat that the Federal Reserve was causing discoordination and causing problems. I mean, so it was not all perfect. I mean, 1929 did come from somewhere, after all. The 1920s did lead to the Depression, after all, so there must have been something wrong. And they said, oh, yeah, no, we'll gladly insert all your caveats. No, nothing. Just everything was great. We had nothing about any of that. Never saw the light. Okay, so the Federal Reserve System is what we'll be talking about, because we're going to get into the Austrian theory of the business cycle. Okay, now I'm not going to spend too much time on this because, you know, I just have to figure you guys know this. And not like everyone in the world knows this, but, you know, you're taking a course through the Mises Institute with me. I mean, like, it all just sort of seems to follow. But for the sake of completeness, I'll give the quick overview of this, and then we'll try to apply it to what happened in the 1920s. Okay. All right, basically it runs like this. Now, of course, the Austrian school, I figure most of you know about, but we're talking about a school of thought that is not, doesn't have anything to do with the country of Austria, except that was the country of origin for some of the economists who whose work gave rise to it. But the business cycle theory is geared toward explaining why the economy seems to move in cycles. Like, how come we're up and then down, up and then down? Why isn't the progress like this? Why does it look like this instead? And we've been given a variety of answers to that question. We've been told that, like, the Marxist view is that that's just inherent in capitalism. It just does this. We've been given psychological explanations that there are animal spirits that move investors. And, you know, you just can't tell when they're going to strike them in a particular way, and they're irrational. And we've been given that. But F.A. Hayek wanted to try another possibility on for size, a non-psychological explanation based on real factors. And the question he's implicitly posing is, and the question that Rothbard expressly poses, and Lionel Robbins, who first coined this phrase, cluster of error, was proposing, was, why is there this cluster of error among businessmen? In other words, how come all of a sudden, like, we're all doing well, and then all at the same time, like, a whole bunch of entrepreneurs make losses? Like, why didn't they anticipate the changed conditions and plan for, like, why are they all making errors and losses at once? And, of course, not everyone during a bust. I understand, of course, that not everybody is making losses. But the point is there's a huge cluster of these losses. And this is particularly interesting given that the market tends to select the best, most skilled entrepreneurs in the first place. Because if you make losses and you're not good at entrepreneurship, you eventually lose market share and may even be driven out of business entirely, and your place will be taken by people who are better forecasters of consumer demand. So why are these particularly good forecasters suddenly guilty of such lousy forecasting? And so the answer has to be, there has to be some systemic problem. There has to be some systemic institutional problem that is causing this such a widespread cluster of error. And so the answer they're going to come up with is this distortion of interest rates on which every businessman relies for making his production decisions. And the whole economy makes production decisions across time based on interest rates. You can't interfere with them. They're not arbitrary. They're real things. So how does this all come together? Well, we have this idea of the structure of production. It's a very Austrian idea. We have to introduce that. Structure of production basically is the doctrine that consumer goods don't just fall out of the sky. They go through a series of stages, and they go from higher order to lower order stages. The highest order stage is the stage that would be the furthest removed from the finished consumer goods. So research and development is a very high order stage. Research and development is before you even have a good. You're trying to research to see if you can develop some kind of new product. But there is no product yet, so that's not even close to a product on a store shelf. Or extraction of mineral resources or mining. These are, again, just very long-term projects and very far removed from a finished consumer good. Or construction work or manufacturing. These are also higher order goods. Producing capital goods, like producing machine tools. Okay, machine tools are not used by consumers, so these are higher order stages. And then you proceed down the structure of production, lower and lower, you get to the wholesaler, you get to the marketer, because that's another stage of production. You have to alert the public to the existence of the product. You have the transportation stage. You got to transport the goods to the retailer. The retailer has to put them on the shelf. And then finally, there you go. There's your lowest order stage, the consumer buying them off the shelf. Okay, now with these things out of the way, basically we go this way. Businesses, of course, are going to engage in their most long-term projects when interest rates are low, because the longer that a project takes before it bears fruit and can yield you a profit, and therefore the longer the period of time you're going to have to borrow money to carry out that project, the more the sting of the interest rate will be felt. And anybody knows that. The longer the term of the loan, the more of the sting of the interest rate there is, because anybody who has a 30-year mortgage knows this. The first year you're paying that mortgage, you can't believe every month how much of your payment is going to interest and how little to principal. And if your interest rate came down, let's say, 2 percentage points, you would notice a huge difference in the amount of interest payment you're making. It'd be much, much less. So that's very interest rate sensitive, home purchases. Well, anything that's long-term would be more interest rate sensitive. Whereas the shorter-term things are not so interest rate sensitive. You know, whether a painter is going to buy a new paintbrush or a new hat really doesn't have a whole lot to do with interest rates. But whether I'm going to buy something that it's going to take 10 years for it to start turning a profit for me, well, I'm going to have to calculate how big do I expect those profits to be and how high is the interest rate. If the interest rate is so high that it cancels out all my profits, then I won't do it. But if it becomes lower, then I will. So you see, some economic activities are going to be more sensitive to interest rates than others. So if you interfere with interest rates, you're therefore going to encourage certain types of activity at the expense of others. So the composition of the economy will change. The combination of this, the way it's all set up will change. Okay, so now let's suppose interest rates just suddenly fall on their own. This means the public is saving more, because increased savings push interest rates down. Because now the banks have more to lend, they have greater quantity to lend, so the price of borrowing becomes cheaper. Like if I have more double bubble bubble gum, the price of any piece of it is going to become cheaper. Well, if banks have more to lend, the price to borrow it becomes lower. When the public saves more, they are deferring more of their purchases off for the future. They're not blowing every penny in their paychecks immediately. And so in purchasing fewer consumption goods in the present, they are doing two things. First of all, they're indicating that we're going to buy more in the future instead of in the present. Okay, and that works out very well, because businesses now are borrowing because interest rates are low, and they're engaging goods industries to release resources. That means if I'm not buying as many iPods or hats or coats or picture frames, then all those industries are going to need fewer inputs, because if people are buying fewer picture frames, you don't need as many inputs for picture frames. You don't need as many trucks to ship them. You don't need as many raw materials for them. You don't need as many workers in retail picture frame stores. Those things are now released. And because they're released, they're now available for the service of all these long-term projects that businesses are engaging in at this time. So all these long-term projects that businesses are engaged in, how are they going to carry all them out? Where are we going to find the resources for them? Well, the answer is the consumer goods industries relatively contract, and that releases resources that become available for use in the higher order stages. Now there are trucking services and employees that are available for the higher order stages of production. So this is why it makes sense for businesses, it makes sense for the whole economy, for businesses to engage in long-term production when interest rates are low. Because there's this great coordination. But what if the interest rates fall artificially? Let's say you have a Federal Reserve System, a central bank. It has various ways to make interest rates fall. Well, in this case, the public saving has not increased. Businesses are engaged in their long-term projects because they see the lower interest rates. But in this case, the lower interest rates are not natural, and so they don't reflect a public that's more willing to wait for the future to buy things. The public wants to buy more of existing goods right now, but businesses have been misled into engaging in long-term product development of new products for the future. So there's a mismatch of time. And also, if we're not relatively decreasing our purchases of consumer goods, then these industries are not releasing resources for the higher order stages to use. So instead of trucking resources, which is just an easy example to use, going from consumer goods to capital goods industries, the trucking stays down here. And so now you've got all these capital goods industries engaged in long-term production, and they expect, they've done their calculation, they expect to pay X amount for trucking and whatever, and then they find that there's a shortage of trucking. They figured there'd be all these trucks sitting around empty. They're not. So how are they going to get the trucking they need? They're going to have to offer higher prices. They're going to have to bid up the price of trucking. And so they're going to try to attract the trucking up to them and the resources up to them. And meanwhile, the consumer goods industries are going to try to bid them right back down again. So instead of a harmonious flow, there's a tug of war over an unchanged resource base. And so costs are going to keep being bid up because both sides want it. Well, I'm willing to pay this much for it. Well, we're willing to pay this much. We're willing to pay this much. The higher costs now make these new projects suddenly difficult to finance. Now you're going to have to go back and maybe borrow more. The interest rates may have risen. The profitability of these projects is in doubt. Consumers are not desiring to wait this long, it turns out, for these longer-term projects. They want the fruits. They want consumer goods right this minute. And they're not willing to save enough to continue to allow these new projects to command enough resources to continue. So that as this tug of war goes on, the consumer goods industries are going to win because they've got consumer demand really behind them. All the capital goods industries has is the central bank and phony baloney money, which eventually will stop. The central bank will put the brakes on. And that's when the economy realizes it has become too ambitious. It's tried to maintain or increase consumer spending and also increase investment spending at once. We're trying to do both things without anybody making any sacrifices or without anything having to shrink. We want everything to grow simultaneously, and it just won't work. Okay, let's move on. So we in fact see that in the 1920s, this is precisely what happened. You had a Federal Reserve System that was inflating the money supply, that was in fact pushing interest rates lower than their market levels, that was encouraging an artificial stock market boom, and as we saw, that it was the capital goods industries that were particularly stimulated during this time, more so than the consumer goods industries. It was a longer-term investment that was particularly stimulated. Well, now there's no mystery there. Now we understand why that would be. Now, the thing is, we don't really see the inflation of the 1920s in the prices that people were paying for consumer goods. It's not evident in price indexes. Because what was happening was, as you can imagine, during the 20s, when you've got transportation increasing dramatically, there are a lot more cars, you got a lot more capital equipment, you got assembly line production, efficiencies in production, a lot more stuff is being produced in the 1920s. So given how much more stuff was being produced, we should have expected the price level to fall to reflect the greater abundance of goods. You know, more goods makes them cheaper. But instead, prices held more or less steady. And so, in fact, the inflation of the 1920s took the form of prices being higher than they would otherwise have been, if not necessarily absolutely higher. In absolute terms, they were higher than they would otherwise have been. So they should have gone down because of increased productivity, but the Fed inflation kept them stable. Okay, let's carry on. Okay, why do they inflate during the 1920s? What's behind this policy of the Federal Reserve? And Rothbard talks about several of them. I think it's chapter 4. One of these chapters is, I should have told you just to skim it, and probably you wound up doing just that. It's extremely technical and gives all the numbers, but when you're making a case as boldly revisionist as Rothbard's, you have got to dot every I and cross every T. Okay, first thing is to stimulate foreign lending. That is, I don't mean lending by foreigners, I mean lending to foreigners. And basically the reason for that is this. In the 1920s, tariffs had gone up considerably. They had gone down under Woodrow Wilson, now they're going back up again. And when tariffs on foreign goods are high, that means the U.S. is not buying as many foreign goods. That's the point of having high tariffs. And if Americans aren't buying as many foreign goods, then foreigners are not in a position to buy as many American goods. Because, you know, we buy from them, and that gives them the wherewithal to buy back from us. But what if we don't buy from them? Well, then they have less wherewithal to buy from us. And so with Americans not buying as many foreign goods, foreign sellers were earning fewer dollars. So how can we get them to start buying American stuff without having to lower our tariffs? The answer? Lend them the money. We'll just create some money and give it to them. Now you can buy our stuff. So you see, it's the typical Mises thing where, you know, one government intervention causes problems, which leads to another intervention. It never occurs to them, just get rid of the initial intervention. Just get rid of the tariff. You won't have this problem. No. We'll keep the tariff. We'll create money out of thin air and hand it to these people. Then they'll buy our stuff. So the thinking was that the inflation by the Fed will lead to more lending in general, which also means part of that would be there'd be more lending to foreigners who can then buy American exports. And Herbert Hoover, who was the Secretary of Commerce during the 1920s, says, and Rothbard quotes him as saying that even bad lending... Okay, did I quote that Herbert Hoover thing? I was just saying Herbert Hoover was arguing that even bad... You can see that on the screen. Even bad loans were good for business. I mean, really. Okay, I don't think it's going to work over the long haul. Okay. So here's the trickiest part, and really do not get hung up on this. You know, it's at some level this is all insane. But to make a long story extremely short, during World War I, the British inflate like everybody. The British inflated. That is, they. Wait a minute. See, we're saying it froze again. Oh, it's okay. I don't know why I'm having so little luck tonight. During my last course, or most of it, it was all smooth sailing. Okay. All right. Sorry about this, people. I mean, I did pay the bill, so I don't know what the problem would be. Sorry. Okay. Anyway, let's zip through this. So the British create all these pounds. It's just, you know, paper money. People in Britain had not been using gold coins for a very long time. Until well into the 19th century, they were not using gold coins. They were using the paper pound. And so anyway, so during World War I, Britain goes off the gold standard. You can't redeem your paper pounds for gold. And the British are just going to keep printing up pounds to buy the stuff they need for the war. All right. So it goes back to the gold standard in the late 1920s. But it does so at the pre-war par of 4.86, sometimes it's technically $4.866, so you could round it up to 4.87, it doesn't matter. But the point is that because the British inflated the pound so much, more than the US inflated its dollar, it shouldn't have gone back at a ratio of one British pound to $4.86. The British pound was not worth $4.86 anymore. It was worth about $3.50. But they went back at 4.86. And there are a variety of reasons for this. None of them, they don't really make sense to me. Oh, it was a prestige thing. We had to stick to our old stand. I mean, I don't know. It's tricky to understand. But as I'll explain on the next slide, gold is going to tend to flow out of Britain. And its whole money and banking system will be thrown into turmoil. And I want to explain that by use of this brief digression. Again, this is not essential that you understand this for this course, and this is by far the most technical material that we have to cover. The whole rest of it, I mean, it is all ham and plax the rest of the weeks, but this is the most technical stuff. I just want to give a brief digression on something called the price-specie flow mechanism that was first described by the economist Richard Cantillon in the 18th century, but more famously by David Hume, and basically it goes like this. It shows how under a precious metal standard, inflation in one country tends to be kept in check. It comes to sort of boomerang back on that country, and they have to stop doing it. And it works like this. The Salerno lecture, he actually talks about the price. I know exactly the one you're talking about because I was there. He talks about the price specie flow mechanism. So if you want more on this to understand it better, you should look in Mises Media for Joe Salerno's talk, International Monetary Systems. Anyway, price-specie flow mechanism works like this. So some country, let's say the U.S., increases its supply of dollars. Now, we all know that leads to higher prices. Okay, and if you need to know why that is, you could ask me later, but it leads to, you know, more money, prices go up. And when prices go up, a couple things happen. Americans don't want to buy as much American stuff because it's all so expensive. On the margin, they'd rather buy foreign stuff because the foreign countries haven't inflated. So there's going to be an increase in U.S. imports as we import more from other places because the American goods are so pricey. And then conversely, there'll be a decline in U.S. exports because foreigners will find that when they convert their money into dollars, it's not going as far as it ought to. Our stuff seems too expensive to them. I mean, this is all in any basic economics textbook will give you this. So Americans will be exporting less and importing more, will be buying more stuff from abroad. So this is called having a balance of payments deficit. U.S. citizens will be spending more abroad than foreigners will be spending in the U.S. But when we're buying goods from the British or the Germans or whatever, they don't want our paper dollars. Paper dollars don't circulate in Britain or Germany. They want whatever currency units. They want the pound or the mark or whatever. And so U.S. importers then are going to need to turn these excess dollars in to get gold to ship abroad. At some point, the British and the Germans want gold. They're sick and tired of having all these paper dollars. They want their gold. There are going to be demands for gold instead of all these dollars floating around out there. So the commercial banks take the dollars to the U.S. Central Bank, which is the central bank is where all the gold reserves under the Federal Reserve, all the gold reserves are centralized at the Fed. And the commercial banks will have to go and get that gold. They'll have to draw down their gold holdings at the Fed. Inevitably, people become aware of this gold outflow, that gold is leaving the system. And the less gold there is, the less confidence people have that their own money in the bank is safe, that the base on which the bank issues the money is decreasing. So people begin worrying about the soundness of the banks. And so they start to redeem their notes and deposits in exchange for gold. So now the commercial banks and the central banks have got a crisis on their hands. That now, because of their initial inflation, a lot of this money is going to start going abroad to people who don't want to just hold paper dollars, who are going to demand the gold in return. And then those demands for gold begin to snowball as U.S. citizens seeing all these demands for gold begin to demand gold. And so ultimately the commercial banks, the central banks have to stop all this inflation because they don't have enough gold to satisfy a lot of these claims. If the claims keep piling up, they don't want the whole system to collapse. So to forestall the collapse of the system, they begin to stop the inflation, reduce the money supply back down, and go back to the way things were. And so Britain's situation is basically, that it's facing in the 1920s, is basically an illustration of the price-specie flow mechanism. It has inflated, and what's going to happen is, because it has inflated, people are going to find that British goods are expensive. They're going to want to get out of the pound and go and buy goods elsewhere. Now, Britain by the 1920s has forbidden British citizens to use gold coin. British citizens cannot convert their pounds into gold, but large institutions can, and banks and central banks can. And that's what they start to do. They start to say, look, I want my gold. I want my equivalent of one British pound. I want you to give me the gold. And what they'll do is they'll take that gold and they'll go into some other country, convert it into another currency, and that currency will have a lot more purchasing power than the pound did. I mean, that's basically the quick thing. And Britain cannot allow this to continue to go on, that these institutions will convert pounds into gold, take the gold, convert it into dollars, say, and then spend the dollars and get one-third more purchasing power than they could have otherwise. If they stayed in the pound, they could get only the equivalent of $3.50 worth of goods. But if they exchange the pound for gold, they can take that gold and get $4.86 and spend that in the U.S. So the gold is just draining out of British coffers, and they want to stop that. How do you stop that? Well, you make everybody else inflate. so that everybody else's currency is just as crummy, so that now people will feel like, well, they have nowhere to flee to. The purchasing power has become equalized because instead of you just decreasing your money supply and having your price level be normal again, you encourage everybody else to increase theirs, and then everything's about the same and everybody's trapped. That was more or less the British strategy. I'm going to skip some of this just in the interest of time. So what's the solution? So you encourage the U.S., as well as a whole bunch of economically less significant countries, to debase their own currencies, and that will relatively strengthen the pound. So the pound is super weak. They've created so many of them, and this is causing all kinds of problems. So the deal is you get everybody to screw with their own currencies, and then things will be better. Okay. There was an extremely close relationship between Montague Norman, the head of the Bank of England, and by the way, this is stuff you do not read in any history of the Great Depression, except in Rothbard. This is all gone. There's no mention of this. Montague Norman is the head of the Bank of England. The New York Fed governor, Benjamin Strong, had a very good relationship with him. Let's remember that at this time, the structure of the Fed was different from how it is now. Today, we think of the Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke and whoever. Nobody even remembers the names of the Fed chairman from the 1920s. They had basically no power. It was the governor of the New York Fed. Now, that was the term they used at that time, governor. Governor of the New York Fed. He was the guy who really ran the show at the Federal Reserve. And they had such a close relationship. They had secret meetings but throughout the 1920s. The Federal Reserve Board did not know about these meetings, so, of course, the general public did not know about these meetings. Benjamin Strong had his own office at the Bank of England. He would pretend anytime he was over there, he'd pretend he was just on vacation. In July 1927, Strong and Norman meet with Charles Riest and Hjalmar Schacht of the French and German central banks. And basically the proposal that's made to them is, we all want to inflate together. And we don't want to be any of us put in an embarrassing situation of people draining gold from our countries to go into, the better economic climate in your countries. Let's all debase together, and then we can all enjoy the fruits of inflation together, and nobody will embarrass anybody else with redemption claims. And Riest and Schacht were just shocked at this and refused to go along with this. And Strong even said to Riest that I will give, quote, a little coup de whiskey to the stock market. Well, I mean, is that the free market at work? A little coup de whiskey from a central banker? Oh, and of course, that he got his wish. He got stock prices way up. It looked like everything was great. Well, basically, he was doing the bidding of the Bank of England. He wanted to help out England. So we're going to inflate in the U.S. so that the primary competitor of the British pound will be debased so that people will feel less tempted to go to it, feel less tempted to turn in their British pounds to get gold and bring it to the U.S. because our dollars are pretty crummy too now. I mean, that basically was it. It's hard to believe. But one British admirer compared Benjamin Strong to Walter Hines Page, and that is a very significant comparison. Walter Hines Page, remember, he was the U.S. ambassador to London during World War I, and he was a guy who, during World War I, on those rare occasions when Woodrow Wilson would send over a slap on the wrist to the British, angry at their violations of international law, Page would sit down. Page was an American. He's the U.S. ambassador. He would sit down with British government officials and help them draft their response to his own country. So when the British say, wow, this guy's just like Walter Hines Page, they mean this guy totally ditches his own country and its own interests in order to align himself with us. I mean, that was the highest compliment they could pay him. And then finally, this was the one thing that Strong would argue that he was doing. He was just helping the farmers. The stimulus to foreign lending would give foreigners the wherewithal with which to purchase U.S. farm exports. And so, you know, this is all I'm trying to do, just help out the farmers. And then finally, price stability. Economist Irving Fisher argued that prices need to be kept stable. This is what keeps the economy on an even keel. So, as I said, prices should have fallen in the 1920s, but this price stability policy was also contributing to the policy of inflation. We got to keep prices at the same level. That was his thinking. If the prices are at the same level, you don't have problems. And so we've got the price stability, we've got the farmers, we've got the help the British, We've got the help U.S. exports. All these things factor in. And then, of course, you know, there are other people who are benefited from the inflation. But finally, I want to conclude with just a few more minutes with contrasting Irving Fisher and Ludwig von Mises on the crash. And Mark Thornton wrote a really great paper on this. I think you can find it. It may have been published by now in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, but it should also be in the Working Papers section. If you type in Thornton, crash, Fisher, Mises at Mises.org in the search box, you should find it. Irving Fisher is sort of like the godfather of modern mainstream economics. And we all know who Ludwig von Mises is, of course. So it's interesting to contrast what they had to say leading up to the crash. Because a lot of times people say, you know, the real test of a science is its ability to predict. And it's funny that the Austrians, ironically, have been the ones who have argued against, you know, we can predict certain things very broadly and in a qualitative sense. But they think it's just mere superstition to think we can say, well, if the money supply goes up 6.3%, the price level will go up 7.1% or something. You know, you can't say anything like that. There's no way, you don't have the right to make a statement like that. Human behavior can't be predicted in that type of way. And yet, it's the Austrians, the ones who are more cautious about prediction, who have been the best prognosticators in the first place. And whereas it's those who talk, who say we're going to live and die by our predictions, who have been the lousy predictors. So here's Fisher. So a little over a month before the crash, he says, and I'm reading this to you not because you can't read, but because some people will be listening to this just on audio. He says, there may be a recession in stock prices, but not anything in the nature of a crash. Dividend returns on stocks are moving higher. This is not due to receding prices for stocks and will not be hastened by any anticipated crash, the possibility of which I fail to see. The next month, he notoriously said that stocks have reached a permanently high plateau. And he said further that he expected to see the stock market a good deal higher than it is today within a few months. And he did not feel there will soon, if ever, be a 50 or 60 point break below present levels. And he says the breaks of the last few days, he says this in October, have driven stocks down to hard rock. I believe that we will have a ragged market for a few weeks and then the beginning of a mild bull movement that will gain momentum next year. Then October 28th, 29th, Dow Jones plummets 25%. Fisher says, November 3rd, stock prices are absurdly low, but they had a much steeper decline ahead of it. By the time bottom was reached, stocks were off nearly 90% of their peak. And Fisher himself lost a fortune in the crash. Now, as I said earlier, fashionable opinion held that the U.S. had entered a new era in which the business cycle would be a thing of the past thanks to scientific management of the money supply, but not Mises. Here he is in 1928 throwing cold water on us. He says, it is clear that the crisis must come. And notice he doesn't say, it is clear that we have stable prices, so therefore everything's fine, and, you know, I don't see any possibility of a crash. He says, it is clear that the crisis must come sooner or later. It is also clear that the crisis must always be caused primarily and directly by the change in the conduct of the banks. If we speak of error on the part of the banks, however, we must point to the wrong they do in encouraging the upswing. The fault lies not with the policy of raising the interest rate, but only with the fact that it was raised too late. And that's typical of Mises, by the way, is his emphasis is really on the artificial boom. That's what his theory of the business cycle is all about. It's about the artificial boom. It's not primarily about the bust. And that's where most economists are focusing their attention, is on the bust. Oh my goodness, we have this bust. How do we fix it? And Mises' argument is really the better question is, why did we have the boom? And, you know, was it an artificial boom? And if so, that helps us understand what just happened to us. Finally, Mises says, the only way to do away with or even to alleviate the periodic return of the trade cycle or the business cycle with its denouement, the crisis, is to reject the fallacy that prosperity can be produced by using banking procedures to make credit cheap. Well, let me conclude with this. I'm noticing I can see myself in the little window here. Can you believe I have the Mises bust? This is a bust of Mises himself that when the Institute first premiered this thing, I showed it showed it to my wife, and she said, that thing is not coming into our house. I think that is it. But then Christmas came, and I opened this kind of heavy box. It was the bust. She had gotten it for me. Oh, my goodness gracious, she had gotten me the bust. Absolutely incredible. And there it is, sitting in the back there. Oh, that's great. Okay. Let's see. All right, well, what we'll do is we'll take questions, and then, and I know I said that I'll skip this or that just a little bit, but anytime I say that, then when we get to the questions, if you want to ask, you know, hey, go ahead and say that, go ahead. I just don't want to deprive you of the question time. But when there's time at the end, then by all means, you know, let's revisit something that I glided over or something. No problem at all. Okay, what we'll do is we'll take I've got 10:05 p.m. Eastern time, a time zone that I myself am not on, and we will take our customary 10-minute break and then come right back. I will go through the questions that have been submitted. Now, I'm going to be going over to – there's a page on the course page that says questions for the professor, lecture one. So post your question there. It makes it easier than using the chat window. And then after I go through these submitted questions, then I'll go to the chat window and we'll see, you know, are there any other questions or is there anything else you'd like to talk about before the session ends? Anything else? Okay, all right, the first question, I was listening to a video by Stephen Cates, and he spoke of how Australia was out of the Depression by 1932 due to their classical approach to the recession. Will we be comparing the recovery of other nations to that of the U.S., such as Australia? No, only because I'm not knowledgeable enough to cover that, but I had heard the same thing. I think it would be quite interesting, and I can refer you to... I can refer you to this, because the follow-up question is, are there any books about the Depression from the British point of view? The one I recommend is Lionel Robbins' book called The Great Depression. And that's, you can read that whole book for free at the Mises website, The Great Depression by Lionel Robbins. An excellent book. It gives an Austrian overview. It was written in 1934. It gives an Austrian approach to the Depression, and it's European-centered. It's got some U.S. stuff in it, but it's European-centered. Lionel Robbins, R-O-B-B-I-N-S, Lionel Robbins. He later became a Keynesian, basically, but this was during his Austrian phase. Okay, let's keep on going here. Got a lot to cover here. Okay, so how does Mises' view of the Depression differ from that of Milton Friedman? This is actually a good book on all this, by the way, is Bob Murphy's book, Robert P. Murphy. Some of you know him, I guess. He wrote a book called The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal. He covers a lot of this stuff and in different schools of thought and how they look at the Depression. But basically, the quick answer is that Friedman and Schwartz would argue that the Depression really was caused by the fact that the Fed allowed or did nothing to counter a substantial drop in the money supply, which led to a substantial drop in economic activity from 1929 to 33. And this failure to reverse this decline in the money supply caused this problem. And the kind of Rothbardian answer, and Joe Salerno has done much more on this, is that the Fed did everything it could in the aspects of the money supply that it directly controlled to reverse this, but it couldn't, because people were taking their money out of the banks, and the banks were failing, and there was nothing they could do. 9,000 banks failed. That's why the money supply fell. And the Rothbardian view is that you don't start in 1929 to figure out what happened. You start in the 20s to figure out what happened. And Milton Friedman's view is that there's nothing wrong in the 20s. Milton Friedman's view is that Benjamin Strong was an excellent Fed governor. There was nothing wrong with his policies. That his policy of stable prices was just right. That's just what the economy needed. So Friedman doesn't see what Rothbard and the Austrians see. He doesn't see the capital discoordination that's caused by the artificial interest rates. That, as I said in my explanation, the interest rate interference with interest rates leads to different things being done than would otherwise have been done. And these different things that are being done are not things that the economy is naturally telling people to do. The economy would naturally be putting up red lights if people were trying to do all these long-term projects. But instead, because of the Fed, all those lights are green. So basically, Rothbard's view is that that it was the intervention of the Fed. The intervention of the Fed is not smoothing over or providing stability to the economy. It's creating all kinds of little micro problems in the economy. It's making this investor do this instead of that, and this businessman engage in this project instead of that, or instead of doing nothing. And these eventually add up, and you have an incompatible mix of market forces. So it is totally different. And there are refutations, I think, of the Friedman view. Gary North, you could find a Salerno. I'll try and dig around for it, but that's basically the quick answer: is that the Friedman view is that just not enough was done to stop the deflation. The thing is that in 2003, the American Economic Review had an article, an excellent article, that spanned 17 countries over the course of like 100 years, and they found that there is no empirical connection between deflation and depression. If you leave out the Great Depression, there is no connection. You are more likely to find economic troubles during inflations than deflations. And basically, the Friedman-Schwartz view is just a hypothesis based on the presumption that deflation causes problems. But now we find that this is actually a faulty assumption. So where does that leave the Friedman and Schwartz thesis? Okay. Let's see. Okay, so the question about the Depression of 20 and 21 and the inflationary policies of the Fed and so on and so forth. Well, basically one thing that I mentioned in the talk tonight was that the Fed did not actually engage in a policy that actually turned around the decline in the money supply until 1922. And so if they're going to try to argue, well, that's what brought us out of the depression of 1920 to 21, they're coming up against the fact that we were already out of that depression by the time they did that. They did lower the discount rate in the summer of 1921, which is the rate at which they lend to banks. And some people say, aha, well, you see, that must have solved the problem. But remember, this is a time of great price deflation. So people are not exactly anticipating a lot of price inflation at that time. And that brings interest rates down naturally across the board anyway, because the interest rate always has built into it an inflation premium. Because if I expect inflation to go up, and so the dollar's not going to be worth so much in 10 years, I'm going to factor that into the interest I charge you on this 10-year loan. You better believe it. And so when prices are generally coming down, interest rates are all going to be coming down because people are expecting prices to keep coming down. So when the Fed did that, it was just really following the markets. That wasn't like a stimulus policy. So I think that's basically the quick answer to that. Okay, and then this question about Rothbard from an article in Inquiry, and he cites these Cleveland Democrats. I think your criticisms are correct of these statements by Rothbard. I mean, it's true that in the late 19th century, he is probably right. I mean, when it comes to people who wanted to monitor individual behavior, those were almost all Republicans. Like for example, alcoholic drink and whatever. I mean, that was not a Democratic thing by and large, up through the late 1890s anyway. And that the Democrats were the party of free trade and free competition. But I do believe that does, and that's probably still true. Woodrow Wilson, though, is a totally different guy. And after the William Jennings Bryan thing, that does begin to change. But you still do see some lingering examples of the old-timey Democrats. But I'm not so sure. I mean, I think that we can say that Coolidge and Harding, as Republicans, they were much more small government than Wilson was. much more so than Teddy Roosevelt was, and much more so than FDR would be. So I'm inclined to be slightly more sympathetic to the Republicans than Rothbard is. I hear this said all the time. The Republicans have always favored big government, whatever. I guess I just don't see it. Maybe I'm just missing something. I don't see that. I mean, I understand the complaints about Lincoln and some other people, and Teddy Roosevelt was certainly not good. But, you know, by the standards of U.S. presidents, I think Hoover and Coolidge, Harding and Coolidge were pretty good, and they were Republicans. So I think your individual criticisms, they seem correct to me. Can I talk about how bubbles/booms and busts prior to the Fed existing occurred? And then there's a follow-up question asking the same thing. Here's what I'll do on this, because there are so many of them that I could talk about. I'll just refer you to sources, some of them online. The first is you could listen to a YouTube that I did that's called, what the heck is it called? Oh, yeah, okay. It's called Monetary Lessons from America's Past. And if you type that into YouTube, Monetary Lessons from America's Past, there I cover a bunch of these. And I basically explain what's going on here. I mean, that in some cases, you are indeed dealing with a privileged national bank that sometimes contributes to the problem, as with the Panic of 1819, which is a classic example of that. I have an article in the works, actually, if I ever could have the time to finish it. I'd like to finish it by the end of next week. It doesn't normally take me that long to do an article, but I just have so many other things that I have to do these days that will go into this in more detail, because there's an article somebody wrote saying, you know, Ron Paul's an idiot because, you know, after Andrew Jackson got rid of the second bank, we had all these problems. You know, why don't you just shut your freaking mouth and let the bankers run everything? I want to go through that point by point, but I recommend that YouTube, and then also Meltdown talks about this a little bit, and Rollback talks about this. Rollback talks about the bank panics of the late 19th century and argues that they were pretty much unique to the U.S. I mean, the types of bank panics we had in the U.S. were around the rest of the world just a mere curiosity. You just don't run into them. So what was it about the U.S. system that was causing this? And I argue that it's these bank regulations that made it impossible for banks to diversify by making them all have just one office. They couldn't branch, not across the town, not across the state, not across the country, no branching. So they were all extremely vulnerable, and they collapsed like that. Whereas in Canada, you know how many bank panics they had in Canada when the United States had 9,000? In the 1920s or early 1930s, Canada had zero. They had none of these crazy regulations, so they had a much sounder banking system. So there's also that. But then I also talk about the severity of these panics. The Panic of 1893 was the worst one. Still, we're talking about depositor losses amounting to 0.1% of GDP, and that was the worst one. Whereas in just the last 30 years of the central bank era, we have had 140 bank crises around the world that have yielded at least 10% of GDP in depositor losses. So even if we just go, we don't even go any further than that, we can see that there's no comparison. But also, fractional reserve banking is a problem. And Jesus Huerta de Soto, in his great book, Money, Bank Credit, and Economic Cycles, explains that, you know, the consequences of this, and that is also at root in a lot of these. And the federal government, in one way or another, connived at the continuation of that practice that leads to instability. But there's so much that can be said, and I give all the citations and further reading in the Fed chapter of Rollback. What is the quick summary response to a Keynesian who claims the Fed could not have caused a boom in the 1920s because we were still on the gold standard? Well, the answer is it's not a 100% gold standard. They could, the British were not even close to being on a 100% gold standard. They had about a 3% gold reserve. 3%! The United States had a Federal Reserve had a larger reserve than that, but they were creating money on top of the gold. They would have gold, but they would create more dollars, then they had gold to back it up. So the answer is that it wasn't a 100% reserve standard. They were able to inflate. And I mean, how could Benjamin Strong, the governor of the New York Fed, how could he say he was going to give a coup de whiskey to the stock market if it's impossible for the Fed to create a boom? Then what was he talking about? Was he drunk? Or did he not understand the nature of his office? So clearly they were able to do this. So that's basically the answer, is that they were not required to engage in 100% reserve banking. Why didn't Americans trade in their dollars for gold in response to the inflation of the 20s? Unlike the British citizens, they still had the ability to do so. I think in large part because they simply may not have perceived it. It just, because to them it looked like, you know, their wages, or the real wages are rising, the prices are stable. It's not so obvious that they're getting screwed. I think that may be the explanation for the average person. The average person in the 1920s was just not reading about gold prices or what you should do with your money. I mean, everything seemed fine. I suspect that's largely the reason. Rothbard argues that Strong and Norman were linked by their mutual connection to the Morgan dynasty. Have any historians ever attempted to disprove this, or is it generally accepted or just ignored? I honestly don't know, because this is an area where Rothbard is so far above me. He was so interested in the rivalry between the Morgans and the Rockefellers, and I frankly can't keep it all straight in my head. So this is an area where I just simply have to defer to him. Then finally, a totally random, let me refresh one more time, make sure there aren't any other ones. I want to do this one here. Oh, there indeed are several more. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Do I understand and or know what the debate between the Austrian economist community is like on the Ricardo effect? I read about it in DeSoto's book on business cycles and couldn't figure it out. Bob Murphy said he wasn't sure he understood it either. Well, there was a student who was a summer fellow at the Mises Institute a couple years ago who did a whole paper on the Ricardo effect and Hayek's view of it and so on. And you know what? I mean, I read the DeSoto book. I read that book. I almost read it twice. I mean, I read it all the way through once and then read select chapters the second time. It has something to do with substituting labor for capital and how this influences a bit. And I don't remember how it all fits in, I'm sorry to say. I mean, I should know this. And frankly, my memory is just not as good as it used to be. If you read the DeSoto section on the Ricardo effect, that's where I would have referred you anyway. So even though I can't remember much about it, doesn't change things much. Yeah, sorry about that. But I'm gonna that's driving me crazy. Like, I'm gonna go back and look at DeSoto just because it drives me crazy that I read this thing and it's just not coming. Okay, let's go on here. Okay, so then the question is do I believe that the major busts are engineered by the central bankers so they can consolidate more? And I was still seeing myself on the screen. And then I froze, so I have a delayed freeze. Okay, I was just noting that James P., in fact, has put the Ricardo effect on the screen. So thank you. That is indeed the Ricardo effect. I forget the deal with the business cycle, but that'll help me. That's good. So anyway, the question was, I'm on a question about, do I believe that the various busts, it's a good yield curve comment. Do I believe they're deliberately engineered as a way of consolidating the wealth of the influential or the central bankers themselves? And I get this a lot, and I don't think it's a silly question or absurd. I wouldn't put anything past these people, but I think by and large not, simply because I think the economy is indeed as complex as Hayek and others have said it is. So, you know, once that genie is out of the bottle, you can't be sure that you can control it. And not only that, it makes them look bad. And we can't discount this. It makes them look bad. And it causes more attention to be drawn to them. And neither of these things do they want. They want to be viewed as demigods. And when under their watch, no matter how they try to blame it all on Bank of America or whatever, it's under their watch that this occurred. They are the chief regulators of the banking system. and they're the ones who were saying that lending standards were sound. This makes them look bad, and I think they generally want to avoid that. And they can't be sure that this is going to lead to a consolidation of their wealth. I mean, it could lead, you know, I think things that are off the table now will be on the table in 15 years when things are really bad. And if I were a central banker, I would want the smoothest economic activity possible, because the worse things get, the more the prospect of seriously reforming or abolishing the Fed seriously comes to be on the table. And I don't think they want that. Okay. Yeah, and I mean, again, with a crisis, it can so easily and quickly spiral out of control. I mean, the butterfly effect is very much at work in the economy in a situation like that. How do you get it back under control? It's easier said than done. Okay. All right. So the question is, what are my thoughts on private fractional reserve banking systems versus a government monopoly fractional reserve banking system? Well, I'd rather have the private ones, because at least they're competing. And Mises' view was, and he was quoting somebody else when he said this, was that I want everyone to have the power to issue banknotes so that no one will ever accept banknotes ever again. Because he thought people would have such a bad experience with it, they would say, you know what, I want the hard money. I don't want your crummy paper. So there's at least a chance that that would come about, and that they would have to, for competitive reasons, they would have to have a higher reserve than banks under this current system have, because they wouldn't have a Fed to bail them out. But one of the things that Huerta de Soto says is that this is an unstable system, and there's always going to be pressure for a central bank to ease the pressures of that type of system. Now, there are some excellent arguments. In fact, can somebody look at, I don't want to, but why should you have to do my dirty work? I'm going to try and find, there's an article in Walter Block's archive at lewrockwell.com. And it's an article about an exchange he had with Brian Kaplan about fractional reserve banking. But the key thing about the article is at the end, he's got a bibliography, mostly of online articles, of pro and con on fractional reserves. Because there are people like DeSoto who argue that in a free society this would not be allowed, because it would be a form of fraud. And there are a lot of people who laugh at that, and oh, ha, 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 it's not fraud or whatever. But actually, it's a much more sophisticated argument than it's usually given credit for. And Walter lays out the best of the pro and the best of the con side at the end of that article. So let me see. Just give me just 2 seconds. I want to just see if I can get that for you. Because it's worth reading, like, Guido Holtzman on the subject of fractional reserve banking. I mean, he's not an idiot. He's making a good argument against it. And De Soto argues that it does have negative economic consequences, as Mises did too. Mises and Hayek were arguing not just that a central bank can cause these problems. I mean, basically their critique applies to fractional reserve banking. All right, now let's see. Gosh, he's written so many darn articles. How can I possibly find the one I want? Ah, you are killing me, Walter. How can you write so much? Ah, I got it. Oh, did you already find it? You all right, well, good. Good for you. Thank you. That is the one, number 110. That is the one. Yeah, and go down there and look at all the stuff. I mean, you never read that in your whole life, right? But, yeah, Appendix 1, Fractional Reserve Banking, Anti-Fractional Reserve Banking, and then Pro-Fractional Reserve Banking. Just read a few of those, you know? I mean, just print them out someday while you're having lunch and read a few of those. They will really help you. Okay, let me go back to the questions, because there are more from this. Thoughts on the inflationary effects of a private fractional reserve system? Okay, well, it would have some, but not as much. How would you treat different bank accounts under such a private system? Well, it depends. I mean, if it's fractional reserves, I don't know how they would. I mean, I under 100% reserves, there would be certain accounts that you would have access to 100% of the time at all times, and so by definition, there can't be two owners of the same thing. So it would have to be just sitting there waiting for you. But there would be other less liquid forms of deposits, like savings would be one example, slightly less liquid. CDs would be more illiquid. And then there you would relinquish control of the money for a certain specified amount of time, and the bank could do whatever it wanted to during that time. It could lend it out or whatever. I'm not exactly sure how it would work under a fractional reserve, how a fractional reserve private system would work. I just don't know, because I mean I just find fractional reserve so bizarre. I can't understand how they would distinguish between all these things. I don't quite know. Okay, why do economists think that deflation is such a bad thing? When is deflation bad? Well, okay, on this I have a section on deflation in Rollback that it was meant to sort of give like the four-page layman's overview of this question. So I first of all I refer you to that. I'll give you an answer right now, but I also want to refer you to the resource that I have right here. I have a section on deflation. Can you believe the domain name learnaustrianeconomics.com was available? So I bought that thing, and I put up some resources. You'll find there's a section on deflation. And I recommend that. There's some audio on it. Guido Hulsman is very good on this, and Joe Salerno is very good on this. But also those sources, some of which are indeed themselves Guido and Joe. Why is deflation a bad thing? Well, there are different arguments that have been made. Some are more primitive than others. One would be business profitability is impossible in an atmosphere of falling prices. Because if prices keep on falling, how can businesses ever profit? Okay, they engage in the production process at a particular price level, and then suddenly they go to sell their product and they find that it's selling for much less than they anticipated. So how can they possibly recoup their costs? That's one argument. But the answer to that argument is they anticipate the deflation. That's what entrepreneurs do. They have to anticipate the behavior of money. And so knowing, therefore, that the price is going to go down for their goods in the future, they bid less today for the factors of production that go into making them. And that allows them to continue to have a price spread between sales revenues and costs. So, I mean, that's basically the answer. If they don't anticipate the deflation, then, okay, then it could well be that they're in a tight spot here. They've produced all this stuff expecting to sell it at $10. They have to sell it at $3. Well, this could lead them out of business. But from the aggregate economic point of view, so what? I mean, I don't mean that to be heartless. It's a shame for them. But we're looking at this as macroeconomists. So what? If they go out of business, that just means they go into bankruptcy court. A business firm that fails to anticipate the deflation may indeed have to go out of business. But what I was arguing was that from the point of view of the economy in the aggregate, this doesn't matter. This just means that the ownership of the goods that that firm once controlled are shifted to another owner, either in bankruptcy court or in some other way. Well, big deal. That doesn't matter to the aggregate economy that Joe Blow owns this firm now instead of, Walter Smith or something. It doesn't matter. Production continues. Production goes on. In fact, the new owner might even have lower costs because he's able to get these assets at low price when they're auctioned off or when they're sold off in bankruptcy court or whatever. I mean, so he can even start in a more auspicious position. So this doesn't matter. This is okay. This is not the end of the world. The Keynesians have an even more elaborate thing about there's a deflationary spiral that would just, we'd never, ever, ever get out of it. It just gets worse and worse. Or that if prices keep falling, nobody ever buys anything. Because we anticipate that prices will be lower next month, why would I buy now? And if they're going to be even lower 2 months from now, why would I buy in 1 month? And so just all activity ceases. But, well, this fails to take into account time preference. Yeah, I know that maybe a cup of coffee might cost 10 cents less 3 months from now. Does that mean I'm not going to buy one today? We all know laptop computers are going to be less expensive next year than today. Does that mean we never buy one because we wait till next year, and then we know that the year after that will be even cheaper, so we keep on waiting. And then on our deathbeds, finally we lurch forward and grab a laptop and a cup of coffee. I mean, it's just not the way it actually is. Now, there are other arguments, too. I don't want to make light of this. But there I really recommend it. The experts really are Guido and Joe. So check out everything they've done on Mises.org on this subject, whether audio or articles. And as I said, I've link to some of them at my learnaustrianeconomics.com. Okay, when is deflation bad? Joe identifies one case, but it's a fairly obscure and very, very rare situation. But there are some people who argue that that it can sometimes be bad. Like George Selgin would argue that it can be bad. If it's just like a sudden drop in the money supply, this can be bad. But if it's if the deflation really is just simply prices are going down because our productivity is going up, that's a good thing. In fact, Selgin wrote a book called, and in fact, I think you can read this in its entirety on Mises, called Less Than Zero. And it's something like the case for a falling price level in a growing economy, something like that. So basically, Guido's view, and I keep citing these people because they're the economists. I mean, I'm just a historian who reads economics. But his view is that there really is no such case, that the deflation clears out the, it doesn't do so precisely, but it clears out the mess of the inflationary boom. It reverses the, it causes a reversal of fortunes in that who benefits from inflation? Well, not the average person who sees his standard of living and the purchasing power of his money go down, but people who do benefit from it would be, let's say some investment bank that's highly leveraged, or some military contractor that gets newly created money very early on in the process. But now in deflation, all the people who lost benefit. I don't know, people who benefit lost. The people on fixed incomes now benefit. The average person who suffered benefits. But somebody who is way, way, way in debt gets hurt. And this is why I think you hear all this hysteria about deflation and no hysteria about inflation. Deflation hurts the powers that be very, very badly, and the government. It's harder for the government to pay its debts. And it can benefit the average person, whereas inflation hurts the average person but benefits the influential, and so we don't hear a peep about them about that. Okay, why is it the relationship between Strong and Norman is only recorded by Rothbard and absent from other works on the subject? I can't account for why other people do what they do, I don't know. They're either not looking, they don't want to tell this story, they don't think it's relevant, I don't know. I wish I did know, but that's something that we'll probably never know the answer to. I'm refreshing one more time to see if anybody is trying to sneak another one in. I'll look at it. Okay. Oh my goodness, you guys are submitting so many of these. Okay. With the recent events in Japan, there are rumors the Japanese central bank might embark on some more quantitative easing. Yeah, I read that too. How do we stop this race to the bottom by central banks trying to devalue their currencies? Does the system have to collapse? Let's see. See, this is a political question, really. I mean, this isn't like a question of knowledge of history or economics. This is how do we do this? And the answer may be there is no way. And I mean, I hate to say that, but there is no way. Now, I mean, the question of how could we could stop them if we wanted to. The Congress could just simply say that we're revising the relevant statutes and saying that the Federal Reserve cannot buy anything anymore, can't buy any more assets. That would stop it. Because how does the Fed create money? By buying things. So you just cut that out. So in other words, we could stop it tomorrow. But the problem is we. You and I can't do jack, well, we can't do much, I'll put it that way. So I don't know what to do. Other than, the only thing I know how to do is give speeches and write. That's all. I stink at everything else. I can't organize any events. I'm a terrible organizer. I can't draw. I can't animate. I can't do it. But we need people who can do all those things. We all have a role in this, but I don't know quite what, and I'm no strategist, because maybe there is a strategist out there who can think of some way we can put this to an end, but that is not my strength in the international intellectual division of labor. Okay, Can you elaborate on the economic hierarchy of value for various goods, e.g. the Keynesian belief that eating a $300 steak dinner is the equivalent value of spending $300 to pay someone to dig a hole and fill it up again? Well, but I mean, in some sense, they are equivalent. In they are equivalent in this sense, that they're both just purely consumption. Whereas a better comparison would be eating a $300 steak dinner or buying a buying a machine that can increase our production of hammers, because the machine that increases our production of hammers pays for itself in the increased production of hammers that we'll get out of it. So it, whereas the steak dinner is just a pure loss, it's gone, that's it. Whereas although the machine will be worn out someday, in the meantime, it has given us a net increase in our well-being. It has more than replaced itself. The steak dinner is just gone. So that, to me, that's the main difference. Maybe I'm not understanding the question. Okay. Do I read Zero Hedge? Not regularly, only when somebody links me to it. Are there any blogs you find to be useful or informative on these topics? I read Mish. I mean, I have an RSS reader. I have Sharp Reader. But, I mean, I'm just always doing so much that I haven't been opening it. I just haven't had time. I mean, I should. And I have Mish on there, and I have Economic Policy Journal. Does everybody read Robert Wenzel? Does that name ring a bell? Or tell me if that name does not ring a bell to someone. Okay, this is it. Okay. Well, even if you don't know who he is, I'm going to tell you right now. You should you should read this, economicpolicyjournal.com. Excellent. Very, very good. And he's very nice to me, too, which I don't know why. He says nice things about me, and I appreciate that. So that's what, he updates his blog like a zillion times a day. But also, there's... Do you guys follow Bob Murphy's blog? He's good. Now he usually posts much more often than he has been lately because he's just been very busy and he's been traveling a lot. But it's worth putting him into your feed as well. Free advice, yeah. It's a typically funny Bob Murphy thing. Consulting by RPM and then the blog. So those are the three that I look at the most. And then of course I look at Mises. I know there are others I should be looking at, but those are my main ones. Let's see. Is it true the Federal Reserve is not buying 60% or so of our treasuries? I don't know that statistic about the Fed buying 60% of our treasuries. I mean, I know there have been statistics of, in a particular couple of months, they've been basically buying like 50%, but it could be 60, I guess. And what would happen if Japan stopped buying our treasuries due to the tsunami, and what if they started selling treasuries? That's a good question. I mean, we might as well get used to it, because if it's not a tsunami they have to deal with, it's going to be the problems that the developed world will be having with the aging of their populations, and they have not made adequate provision for this problem. And, the idea that I'm going to keep lending to the U.S. at a totally piddling return when we have pressing problems at home, what will happen? Well, I mean, I think you can take a guess. I mean, interest rates will go up when because the demand falls. A major buyer stops buying or sells, the demand falls. So you got to sell them somehow. So the interest rates will go up, I say at the end of rollback that at any time. Just it could be, we don't know what's going to push the thing over the cliff, but it's just, it could be one bad headline. It could be one thing like this that that causes the incorporation of a major risk premium into lending to the U.S. government, and then the financial, the problem of financing everything then comes in. How do they pay to borrow all the money they need to borrow? Okay, I have got that as the last of the questions. So I've got about, because I told my wife I would be off by 11 p.m. Eastern. So let me ask if if there's is there anything you want to ask or say that well, first of all, did I mention New Hampshire? Is there any did I mention the New Hampshire event? Tell me if I mentioned that or not, because I had a class earlier tonight and my short-term memory is terrible. Did I mention the New Hampshire thing? Okay. If any of you are in the New Hampshire or Massachusetts area, Saturday, this coming Saturday at Southern New Hampshire University, I'll be speaking and a bunch of other people will be speaking at the Nullify Now New Hampshire event. So it's, and you can find details on in the little event thing on my website, tomwoods.com. So I hope to see if any of you are in the area, we'll have a great time. Oh, I haven't done anything funny on my quizzes, I'm sorry to say. In the classroom, I used to be a little funnier. But anyway, so look that up if you're in the area. We'll have some fun. And yeah, I'll be in Montana May 14th. That's also on my website. I don't have any details as to exactly where the event will be, but I know it's May 14th in Bozeman. Okay, now is there anything, when in New Hampshire, Saturday from 10 to 5, I don't know exactly when I go on, but just check out tomwoods.com and you'll see in the right-hand column it's events. Just click on the New Hampshire event for March 19th. We've got a couple minutes. Is there any non-course related thing, just wacko, off-the-wall thing you'd like to ask? I'm really asking for it here. What do you want to ask? Ask anything. You have like 2 minutes. What question could you ask? Oh, thank you, Floyd. Thank you, Floyd. I wish I could be just down the hall. But we'll see you again in June. This is Floyd Lilly, by the way, who has read so much of the audio material. She read all of Conceived in Liberty, the four-volume Rothbard Colonial America for Mises.org. She reads an enormous amount from Mises.org, and here she is with us. Okay. Oh, final thought. No, I don't know. I don't know anything about that. What do I think of the Free State Project? I promote that in Rollback, so I like those people. My next live music concert is, well, you joke about that, but I can't say yet who it is, but there's a major organization that's having a conference in September, and part of the conference is going to be a karaoke event that they want me to MC. So, good heavens. Howard Zinn. Well, I put a Howard Zinn article in my book, We Who Dare to Say No to War. So I think he's good on some things and really, really bad on others. My favorite hockey team is the Boston Bruins because I grew up in Massachusetts. And I still remember a lot of the players from the 1980s, and I had a Ray Bourque jersey. Floyd, you went to see Roger Waters? Man, we have stuff to talk about, man. Oh, I already answered the Free State Project. I like it. I mentioned it in Rollback in the last chapter. Yeah, I already answered the Free State Project question. Floyd, I am shocked that you went to see Roger Waters. That is so great. Wow, yeah. I went to see Roger Waters in Omaha because I was going to be out of town when he was in Kansas City, which would have been the closest. So I had to drive 3 hours, but I said, no, I am not missing this. So I went. And, of course, I don't know anybody in Omaha, and my wife couldn't come because she had to watch the kids. We couldn't get a sitter. So I basically went on Facebook, and I looked around for friends from Omaha, and I just wrote to one and said, hey, you want to go see Roger Waters? So that's what I did. Okay. Well, I guess that is everything. So thank you, everybody, for sticking around, and I hope it was okay. And as I say, this is the most technical stuff. The rest of it is lots of fun. So thank you, guys. Thanks for the support. Have a good night, and we will see you 1 week from freaking tonight. Have a good one, everybody. Thank you.